We are starting a new book today. And I have to say, it's not just me. It's probably lots of people's favorite Tanakh book. Sefer Shmuel, we're going to talk about, is it one or two? Sefer Shmuel is an incredible literary masterpiece. Forget about the messages and the trajectory of the story, but just the characters and the way the story is built and the language. It's just a very powerful, very real story, right? We really get to understand the personalities. And if you haven't read it or you haven't read it in a while, go back and read it again. We are going to look at some things. We're not going to see everything in the book. One of the powerful stories of Sefer Shmuel is, I'll borrow my friend Shani Tarragon's term, from anarchy to monarchy. Right. If we were talking about Sefer Shoftim as just this free for all, Ish HaYashar Be'Einav Yaseh, everybody does whatever they want, Ein Melech B'Yisrael, there's no king in Israel. Sefer Shmuel is the way that we finally get on the path to having a true leader, right? It begins with Shmuel, who is a true judge and a prophet, someone who's a force to contend with. We go through a king that is somewhat a failed king, right? Shaul, King Saul. And we get to David, the Davidic dynasty, which is, of course, the ideal kingship. Now, by the way, it's not so clear from the Torah, from Tanakh, that a king is the ideal form of government. That's a very interesting question, and different Mefarshim talk about the Barbanel, for example. And in Sefer Shmuel, Shmuel himself is not very pleased about this idea of having a king, right? And God says to him, no, 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 this is what the people want. And he says, well, they should only have you, God, as your king. But we saw that didn't work so well in Sefer Shoftim. So perhaps the people have a point. But that's really the trajectory of the book. The story of Shaul HaMelech, of King Saul, in the first book of Samuel, is a very powerful, tragic story. And you can talk about, you know, was he a preordained tragedy, meaning he's not from Beit David, he's not from Shevet Yehudah, maybe he never was meant to be king and he didn't really have a chance, or is he just someone who has character flaws, and those kind of take over? So we'll look a little bit at that, but that's also another interesting theme to talk about. And finally, just again as an introduction, there are not two books, right? There's not Shmuel Aleph and Shmuel Bet, right? There's the old joke that if you go to Nebi Samuel, which is supposed to be the grave of Shmuel Hanavi, right? So this is Shmuel Aleph, and then the other one down the road is Shmuel Bet, right? There are no two Sefer Shmuels. The division of the book into two is relatively late. Part of it is connected to the Christian division of the chapters, right? You know, the Prakim and Tanakh, the chapters in Tanakh, are not a traditional way of looking at Tanakh, a traditional Jewish way of looking at Tanakh. In the Middle Ages, 13th century or so, the church divides up the book into chapters, and that's why the chapters don't always make so much sense. They're useful, but they don't always make so much sense. I will quote somebody who doesn't really deserve to be quoted because he was a horrible anti-Semite, but he says a very interesting thing. And this is Jerome, right? Jerome, one of the church fathers in the 4th century, and he says that there are 22 books of Tanakh. You'll say there are 24. Okay, he says there are 22, like the 22 letters of the Hebrew alphabet. And just like in the letters, there are five double letters, right? There's the menatzpach, right? The mem and the mem sofit, the nun and the nun sofit, etc. There are five of them. He says there are five double books. Well, that's kind of cute, even though he was not a nice guy, right? What are the double books? Sefer Shmuel, right? One and two. Sefer Melachim, Kings, one and two. Divrei Hayamim. And then he puts together what the Gemara puts together as well, Ezra and Nehemiah as one book, and Yirmiyahu and Echa, right? Yirmiyahu and Echa, I think, is only his idea, but it's an interesting idea. Okay, but we are going to do today, just for convenience sake, we're going to talk about the first book of Shmuel, and next time we'll talk about the second, even though, like I said, it's a pretty fake division. The picture you're looking at is going to be one of the places we're going to focus on today, and that is Mount Gilboa, Har Gilboa, the scene of the tragic end of King Saul's life, the battle against the Plishtim, and you really have this gorgeous view of the Gilboa looking out towards the Jezreel Valley, which we talked about last time, looking out towards Givat HaMoreh, and this is actually a great view because, as we'll see, the Plishtim are camped over here at the foot of Givat HaMoreh, and eventually, Bnei Israel and Shaul are camped on the Gilboa, so you really can see how they are facing off across the valley. Okay, a brief outline. Like I said, we're not going to look at everything, so let's have at least a sense of the shape of the book. So the first three chapters are based in Shiloh. Okay, they are about the birth of Shmuel, of our prophet, right? It's a story, the powerful story of Hannah. We talked about it last time. We talked about Shiloh, Shmuel's birth and his youth growing up in the Mishkan, and also the downfall of Eli, the high priest, because of the sins of his sons. So that's the beginning of the book. The next three chapters are about the terrible defeat of the Israelites at Afek, and of course the capture of the Aron, of the Ark of the Covenant, and its journey throughout Plishti land and its ultimate return. Okay. The next few chapters are about Shmuel as a leader, right? Leading the people into battle against the Plishtim, dealing with the request to have a king, and ultimately the choice of Shaul, of King Saul, as a king from Binyamin. We have 11, 12, 13, 14, 15 are the chapters about Shaul, right? And some of them are very positive, at least in the beginning, right? We have Shaul going out to defend the people of Yavesh Gilad. We have him going to fight Amalek, but we see that the trajectory is a downward one, and he sins twice, really. Once by not waiting for Shmuel when to give a sacrifice at Gilgal, and once by not following Shmuel's instructions about killing the Amaleki king. And it's kind of a tale that is, you can tell what's going to happen. And Shaul doesn't back down. He doesn't apologize, even though in the Gemara talks about this, right? David's sins are much greater, but he immediately acknowledges that he is wrong. He immediately asks for atonement. And Shaul is always, oh, really, it wasn't. I didn't. Right? He's always making excuses. And that really leads to his downfall. By chapter 16, God says to Shmuel, Shaul is not going to be the king. You need to choose a new king. He goes to Beit Lechem. He goes to the household of Yishai. We have the very unlikely, right? The classic Tanakh story of the older children being passed over for the youngest. If you're a youngest child, you should take great comfort from this, right? David is the one who's almost forgotten, right? Oh, don't you have another son? Oh yeah. Right. And he's the one who's anointed, but he's not going to become king. The turning point in the book really is chapter 17, right? The major battle in Emek Ha'ilah. We're going to talk about that. And from that point on, David is both connected to the house of Shaul. Do I have to mute everybody, Rabbi Kalman? Because I'm the host now. I think I do.
I'll reclaim the host and mute, and then when I have to leave, I'll give you back. So I'll try
that
to take
would be the best. Helpful.
Sorry.
Thank you.
Sorry about that. Yeah. Okay.
Okay, I'm just hearing lots of little noises. So that's kind of a turning point of the book. And then the next 10 chapters are David, on the one hand, being brought very deep into Shaul's household. He marries Shaul's daughter. He is best friends with Shaul's son. He plays music so that Shaul's madness will be calmed. But on the other hand, he is stalked by Shaul. The jealousy overcomes King Saul, and he has to go, and he has to fly away, and he has to run and go all over the place, and we'll see where. Okay. The last few chapters of the book, and I included the first chapter of Shmuel Bet because it's connected, is the final battle on the Gilboa against the Philistines. With its kind of cut, and this is one of the examples of why it's such a literary masterpiece, this book, cutting back and forth with David with his own problems, right? Escaping the battle with the Plishtim and dealing with his men in the south. And we'll come back to that. And finally, the famous Kina, right? David's lament about Saul and Jonathan when he hears about their death, and his Kina David. So that's just our basic look at the outline of the book. Where do the stories take place? So yes, we've seen this map many times before. It's just a useful map. So where are we taking place, right? We have, of course, the stories of the beginning of the book, that are taking place in Shiloh, right? King Saul is coming from Binyamin. So let's say that both of these places, this area is what we would call the heartland, right? The mountains. This is the place that is the stronghold of Bnei Israel, right? They are really most powerful in the mountains. The Plishtim, on the other hand, over here on the coast. That's why it's rather disturbing when we get it later on in chapter 13, chapter 14, that the Plishtim are battling against Shaul here in Michmas, deep, deep in the heart of the mountains. And of course, at the end of the story, they're all the way up here in the Jezreel Valley. So they make very, very significant inroads into the land, right? What other places are we talking about in the book? Okay, we also have the whole area of the desert. This is where David goes, right? He's running away. He goes to En Gedi. He goes to Zif, right? We have this whole area. He also goes to Plishtiland ultimately. And of course, we have the conflict area, right? The area of Emek Ha'elav, the Elah Valley, where we have the conflict between David and Goliath. Okay, so that's just to give us a little bit of a sense. The Plishtim on the coast, but making their way all the way up to the valley, the Israelites in the mountains, and the struggle between the two in the Elah Valley. Okay, so that's just to give us a little sense of place. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the Philistines, about the Plishtim. From the middle of Sefer Shoftim, of the Book of Judges, until deep into David's kingship, the greatest enemy of the Israelites is the Philistines, right? Are the Philistines. They are pretty much vanquished by David. However, they don't disappear. Okay. And we know, we hear about them in the later Nevi'im, right? Particularly Yirmiyahu talks about them. We hear about them in the later Nevi'im. They manage to hold on to their major cities, and they are only exiled. They're only destroyed when we are captured and exiled by the same people. The Babylonians come to Jerusalem. The Babylonians also come to Ashkelon and to Gaza, and they also conquer the Plishtim. The difference being that we ultimately return. The Plishtim never reconstitute themselves as a nation, but we'll come to that story a little later. Okay. But who are the Plishtim? They are not an indigenous people of the land, just like the Israelites are not, right? We both come from outside. And where are they coming from? So today we have a modern term. We call them the Sea Peoples. This is not a term that we have in ancient texts, but it's clear both from Tanakh as well as from archaeology that they are invading. They are coming in from the west, right? From the area of Greece, of the Aegean Sea, right? We hear about this in Tanakh. So if you look at Sefer Amos, right? To me, Israelites, you are just like the Ethiopians. I brought Israel from Egypt, but the Plishtim from Kaftor. Right? Kaftor is Crete. You can see it over here. And the Arameans from Kir, right? Don't think you're so special. Everybody was brought from a different place, including the Plishtim, right? And say for Yechezkel, I will stretch out my hand against the Philistines and cut off the Kreti. Kreti, maybe from Crete, Cyprus, unclear exactly where, but certainly somewhere here in the islands, in the sea, right? In the Mediterranean. And again, we have the Kreti in Sefer Tzfania, nation of Kreti, who inhabit the coast. So what's the deal with these guys? Why are they coming? The 12th century is a time of great migrations. It's very interesting. If you look at human history, there are time periods where everybody seems to pick themselves up and go somewhere, right? Think about the late 19th century, obviously for Jews, but not only. Think of the huge influx of people that left Europe and came to North America because of new opportunities, because of troubles at home. The 12th century before the Common Era is a similar thing. A lot of nations pick themselves up and move somewhere, whether it's because of political upheavals, right? Egypt is not as powerful. There's kind of a vacuum of power, whether it's because of natural upheavals, the volcano in Santorini erupts and causes great destruction. You need a new place to live. And in the 12th century, the Plishtim coming from the west, okay, the Israelites coming around from Egypt and from the east, they both enter the land of Israel at the same time. We have great archaeological evidence about the Plishtim in Egypt. Okay? In Egypt, there's a place called Medinat Habu. It's the funerary temple of Ramses II, one of the great paros of Egypt, probably the paro of the Exodus. And on the walls, besides, there's a dedication that talks about how Ramses vanquished the Shekelesh and the Shardona and the Peleshet, right? And all these people who came to invade him, because first they come to Egypt, but they get kicked out and they go up the coast towards the land of Israel. And we have pictures of these strange warriors who are being led away in captivity. And this is the reason, by the way, that we know what the Plishti dress was like, assuming the Egyptians are portraying them accurately. And everybody's wearing one of these neat feathered headdresses, right? And the Plishtim seem to have a thing for feathers and for birds. The pottery that we've discovered in their sites, a lot of it is decorated with birds. So it's just interesting to have a snapshot of what they look like, or at least how the Egyptians believed that they looked. Okay, so they get kicked out of Egypt, but they make their way up the coast. There are a lot of different groups. Some of them are mercenaries. Professor Aaron Mayer, who's a big scholar, archaeologist, is the one who dug Tel Safi, which we think is Gat. He calls them pirates. He says these are guys who are out on the sea. They're looking for a new place to live. They're looking for treasure, and they're an ancient version of pirates. So that's an interesting way to look at it. Where do they go? So we hear in Tanakh about what we'll call a fancy name, a pentapolis, right? A group of five cities, Gaza, Ashkelon, Ashdod, Ekron, and Gat. Okay, these are the five major cities. Gaza, Ashkelon, and Ashdod were always known, right? Their identity was never lost. People lived there. They were just well-known places. Ekron and Gat were lost for a long time. We're going to tell the story of the discovery of Ekron in a little bit. Today we are positive we know where Ekron is. Gat, we're 99% positive we know where it is. What you can see is that they are either on the coast or very close to the coast. This is their center, right? But we know that there are Philistine settlements in other places as well, right? We found remains of them in what today is northern Tel Aviv, what was called Tel Kasila, in Afek over here, right? In other places, there are Plishtim who are settling all along the coast. We don't have proof positive yet, but we're pretty sure that they were in Akko. We're going to talk about them in Beit She'an. So the Plishtim definitely, and two times ago, we talked about the Shardona in El Ahwat, right, who are also part of this kind of a loose confederation of these people who invade. So the Plishtim are powerful. They control a lot of land, and at their height, they control much more than just these five cities. One more thing about the cities, it seems that even though each one is ruled by its own leader, right? We have what are called the Sarnei Plishtim, right? These kind of, I don't know, something between a prince and a feudal lord, right? They are connected to each other. They work together, and there seems to always be a first among equals. At one point, Ashdod is the most important city. At another, Gat is the most important city, right? It depends on the time and the geopolitics. Okay, so we have this great story at the beginning of the book. Terrible story, but a great story, right? The Israelites go into battle against the Plishtim. They go into battle at a place called Afek. We're going to see where that is in a second. They are very nervous. So they go to Eli, the high priest in Shiloh, and they say to him, we'd like to take the Ark, the Aron, with us, because that's going to help us to win in the battle. The Tanakh doesn't record Eli's response. It does record how nervous he is until the Ark comes back. Presumably, he didn't think it was a great idea. They take the Ark into battle, and there's a fascinating response, right? If you look at Sefer Shmuel, the fourth chapter, the Plishtim see the Aron, and at first they freak out. This is the Ark of the God who defeated the Egyptians, and we're never going to succeed. And then there's like a turning point, and they say, no, no, man up, Plishtim. You can fight this God. Don't be intimidated by this Ark. And they go into battle. The battle is a terrible rout. The Israelites are defeated. The sons of Eli are killed, and the Ark is taken, is captured, and brought to Plishti land. So we're going to look back at this in a minute, but this is a great picture from a synagogue called Dura Europus, one of the oldest illustrated synagogues, not in the land of Israel, but in Syria. And it has all of these pictures of stories of Tanakh, Midrashic, as well as, you know, just the text. And this is the Aron being brought back with all the treasures that were sent along from Plishtiland. We're going to talk about what is the route that it goes on. So we are going to come back to this text, but let's understand where we are going, right? So the ark starts out in Shiloh, right? It's taken to the battle, which is in Afik and Ebenezer. This is a very important bottleneck on the sea road, on the Via Maris. Anyone who controls this narrow passageway controls that road. So you can understand why they go into battle. Like we said, the Israelites leave. They're defeated, not leave, they're defeated. The messenger goes back to Shiloh to tell Eli, who falls down dead. Meanwhile, the ark is taken first to Ashdod, then to Gat, then to Ekron. Why does it keep being moved from place to place? Because everywhere it goes, it brings gifts. Not really, right? Terrible things happen every time it goes to one of these cities, whether it's the temple and the god Dagon falling down and just crashing and dying, whether it's the people all getting sick, right? And every city, Ashdod says, well, you know, we've had it long enough. We don't want to be greedy. Let's pass it on to Gat. And the Gat says the same thing. And finally, it comes to Ekron, and the people of Ekron say, enough is enough. We are going to send it back to Israelite territory, right? And here's where we have this fascinating test that they do. So let's just go back for a second, right? They say, let's send the ark on a wagon with cows, with nobody to lead it at all, right? And let's see if the wagon goes straight into Israelite territory, then clearly God was the one who's behind all of this. And if not, Yadanu ki lo yado nagabanu mikra yalanu. It was a coincidence, that's all, right? So what do? They make a wagon, they put on it all sorts of gifts, right? Golden mice, etc. And then they let it go. And what happens? They follow behind, as you can see in the picture, they're following at a safe distance behind. And the cows went straight ahead along the road to Beit Shemesh, right? Meaning Beit Shemesh is the first stop in Israelite territory. They went along a single high road, lowing as they went, turning neither to the right or the left. The lords of the Philistines walked behind them as far as the border of Beit Shemesh. The people of Beit Shemesh were reaping their wheat harvest in the valley. They looked up and saw the ark, and they rejoiced when they saw it, right? This very exciting moment. Here it is coming back. Okay, so we go from Ekron directly to Beit Shemesh. The later route of the ark is also interesting, but not for us to talk about right now. Now, Beit Shemesh, we know where it is. Right? I think everybody here knows where the modern city of Beit Shemesh is. Long before the modern city of Beit Shemesh was built, already in the 19th century, the Tell of Beit Shemesh was discovered. Right? Here it is. We'll talk about the other side of the road in a second. Hey, the Tell of Beit Shemesh been excavated. It was a Canaanite city, then it became an Israelite city, right? And we knew where Beit Shemesh is, but where was Ekron? Ekron was not a place that was really very known. But according to the story, it should be just across the valley from Ekron. And we have this amazing story, right? There's another site that's called Tel Mikneh. It's right near a kibbutz called Rivadim. If you know a little about Gush Etzion, you may know that one of the four original kibbutzim of Gush Etzion before 1948 was called Rivadim. When Gush Etzion fell to the Jordanians in May of 48, three of the kibbutzim reconstituted themselves and built new places not far from Ashdod, not far from Beit Shemesh, right? To the west of Beit Shemesh. And one of these kibbutzim was called Rivadim. And one of the members of the kibbutz, someone named Natan Idlin, was, like most Israelis of the time, an amateur archaeologist. And he would walk around outside of the area of the kibbutz, and he saw that there was a large archaeological site outside. It was called Tel Mikneh. And he wandered around, and he noticed that there was a lot of Philistine pottery. It wasn't a really seriously excavated site. Nobody really had, stuff was just lying around. And he saw that it clearly seems to be a Philistine site. And he said, well, that's very interesting. Could it be that it's one of these five cities? Now, remember, there are only two unidentified, Gat and Ekron. Which one would it be? And Natan Idlin, who was a secular guy, but he knew his Tanakh backwards and forwards, He lifted up his eyes and he looked to the east. And what does he see directly in a straight line from Rivadim? He sees Beit Shemesh. And he says, it must be that this is Ekron, because if the cows set out from here going in a straight line towards Israelite territory, then they are going to end up in Beit Shemesh. And this was his supposition in the 1950s. Okay, just one last thing about the picture down here. This is the eastern side of Route 38. Okay, the western side has been excavated for over 100 years. The eastern side, when the city of Beit Shemesh decided they needed to widen this road because they have many, many more residents now than they did 20 years ago, they had to do an emergency salvage excavation, and they unearthed this incredible, incredible archaeological site, which is basically a continuation of the tell from the other side of the road. So that's an interesting story in and of itself. But let's get back to Natan Idlin. So already in the 50s, he determines that Rivadim, Tel Mikneh, is Ekron. In the 1990s, the welcome to Ekron sign was found. Okay, in an archaeological excavation in Tel Mikneh, they found this inscription, which if you look at it carefully, you can see has these Semitic letters, right? These letters that are very similar to the Ktav Ivri Atik, to the ancient Hebrew alphabet, because the Plishtim are master assimilators, and they start to write in the way that the other peoples of the land write. And what does this inscription, which is from the 7th century BCE, say? The temple which he built, Achish, son of Padi, son of Yesad, the ruler of Ekron. It's the ruler of Ekron. This is the welcome to Ekron sign. So what Natan Idlin figured out from knowing Tanakh and knowing geography, today we have proof of in archaeology. Okay, just a last few things about the Plishtim. One of the things that Tanakh does not do very much of, which you can understand why, but it's a little, hard for us because we want to know more. Tanakh doesn't tell us a lot about idolatry. Idolatry is stupid. We don't care about it. We don't need to know so many details, but we want to know more details, right? So when we talk about the Plishtim, all we hear about them in terms of their cult and their religion is they have a god named Dagon, right? What is Dagon? Various commentaries have said it's like a dog, like a fish, because they live by the sea, or it's like grain, like Dagan, because their land is very fertile. So far, nobody has found a Dagon figure, right? And the other thing that is emphasized over and over and over again when the Tanakh talks about the Plishtim is that they are uncircumcised. Arelim, Arelim, they are Arel, everything about them, they are super uncircumcised, right? And that's all we know. Now, fascinating, the Arel, we didn't find anything about Dagon, but we did find things about the Arelut. What do I mean by that? A lot of their cultic objects look very phallic. Okay? One of their goddesses is somebody named Phangea, who's a female with a phallus. So this is something that is clearly an important and sensitive topic for the Plishtim. So that's an interesting thing. We still don't know enough, but we know a little bit. What else have we found? We found one goddess, this one. She was found in Ashdod, so it's called Ashdoda. All you can see is that it's a female, right? She's got nice little breasts, but also a chair, probably some kind of a fertility goddess. We found incense stands, mini temples with idols inside, not with idols inside, just the mini temples, excuse me. And this, which is a fascinating find that was discovered in Tel Asafi in Gat, an altar, you can see it has two horns. Israelite altars have four horns. This is a two-horned altar lechatchila. It's not that two of the horns were cut off. It's built like this. And the suggestion is maybe it's supposed to look like a like an ox, like a bull. Again, a lot of things that we don't know, although archaeology is filling us in a little bit more. And the last thing is, it's always interesting to know what did people eat, what did people drink? And when we know that, sometimes it helps us to identify a site if there aren't other things that identify it. So one of the things that the Plishtim, what do they like to eat and drink? If you were invited to a Plishti banquet, what would you get? You'd get a lot of pork and you'd get a lot of beer. Okay, they ate a lot of pigs. Pigs was a big thing for them, which is interesting because Israelites might worship idols, but they didn't eat pigs. And it seems like the Canaanites also stop eating pigs because they want to dissociate themselves from the Plishtim. But the Plishtim eat pigs, and we find this nice pig skull, right? This is one of the examples. We find a lot of pig bones in Plishti sites. And they like beer, right? We find a lot of beer jugs. You can see here the nice bird decorations. How do we know this is a beer jug? Because if you look carefully, you can see that it has this little strainer in the spout, right? And when you made beer in the old days, it still had the hops inside. You don't want to eat that, so you have to strain it out. So it's always interesting to know what people ate, what people drank. You see the types of pottery they use. It helps us to identify sites. Okay, well, that's our plishti. One more little plishti thing, and that's gat, right? So we don't know where gat is. We didn't know where gat is, rather. You might know that there's a city in Israel called Kiryat Gat, right, which is on the way to Ashkelon. It's a likely candidate for Gat. It was named Kiryat Gat in the 50s because they thought maybe this is Gat, but it's not. Now, Gat today, we are 99% sure, is a very large tell to the north of Kiryat Gat. It's called Tel Asafi. It's been dug for the last 20 years more by Professor Aaron Mayer. It's a massive, massive place. It's a bit south of Ekron. It's due west of the area of Emek Ha'ilah, of Azeka, as we're going to see. It's about 500 dunam, very, very large city that controls all the area around it. It doesn't make it to the end, to the Babylonian conquest. It's already conquered by the Arameans and destroyed already in the 8th century, and it loses any kind of status it ever had. But one of the fascinating things that was found there, tons of stuff was found there, pottery and the altar that we saw, but this little pottery sherd, which you can see is very small, okay, it has an inscription, and it has those nice Semitic letters again, but the inscription is a name, and the name is Waliatus Aluatus. Hey, Waliatus Aluatus. Sounds a little bit, if you stretch it a little, like Goliath, Goliatus, right? Is this Goliath's, I don't know, drinking mug? Probably not. But what it does show us is this is not a Semitic name, right? Goliath is not a Semitic name. Aliatus, Waliatus is an Indo-European name. And it shows us that this is a different culture, right? And the name Goliath fits with that culture. So that's just an interesting find that was discovered in Gat. And one last thing that was found in Gat just recently, and this connects to our little bit later to our story of David and his wanderings and escaping from Shaul, at the foot of the tell, the archaeologists a few years ago discovered what they believe is the city gate, right? You could see a guard tower over here on the left. You could see part of the walls on the right here. And we have a great story of the city gate, okay? In his wanderings, when David is running away from Shaul, one of the places he goes, where Shaul never going to go, never going to follow him, to Plishti land, because Plishti land is very dangerous. So he runs to Gat, and he's going to come back to Gat. But here in chapter 21, it's not such a friendly environment. People start saying, oh, is this the guy who killed our champion, who killed Goliath? Oh, that's him. Oh, that's the one they sing about. And he starts to get very nervous. And so he figures what's an escape route. He's going to pretend to be crazy. And if he's crazy, they'll leave him alone. So what does he do? He concealed his good sense from them. He feigned madness for their benefit. He scratched marks on the doors of the gate and let his saliva run down his beard. And the operative words here are the doors of the gate. If this is the gate, do we find, you know, the scratch marks of David? No, but it's kind of neat to be able to place the story in its context. Okay, like I said before, chapter 17, the story of David and Goliath, is a turning point in the book, moving from being a Shaul-focused story to a David-focused story. Okay? Emek Ha'ilah is in the meeting point between the mountains of Yehuda and Yisrael and the coast of the Plishtim. Each group wants to conquer the other. So each one, of course, marches in the direction of the other, and they meet in Emek Ha'ilah. Emek Ha'ilah is a classic place of conflict. Hey, we have it with the Assyrians, and we have it with the Greeks, and we have it lots of different places because it's a meeting point of cultures. We're going to see very specific where they are, right? This is looking a view down from Tel Azeka, okay? Looking down at the road, and it's between Azeka and Soho. So we are on Azeka over here. This is Soho over here, and the mountain in the middle is a place called Kayafa, which is a fascinating story. We're not going to do a class on it because I did it about a year ago, but it's also part of our David story, right? But the battle is going to take place in kind of almost a natural theater down in the middle where everybody is going to see what's going to happen. And what happens is that every day this giant Goliath goes out from the Plishti camp and challenges the Israelites to take him on. Okay. This is my son dressed up as a Plishti warrior in the Plishti Museum in Ashdod, where they have all these great costumes. Why do we know what the Plishtim look like? Remember, we look back to the Egyptian archaeology, and we know they have the feathered headdresses and the spears, and we also have it in this description. Okay, so take a look. The Plishtim assembled their forces for battle. They massed at Socho of Yehuda and encamped at Ephes Damim between Socho and Azekah. Saul and the men of Israel massed and encamped in the Valley of Elah. They drew up their line of battle against the Plishtim. The Plishtim stationed on one hill, Israel on the opposite, the ravine was between them. The champion of the Philistine forces stepped forward. His name was Goliath of Gat, and he was 6 cubits and a span tall. Okay, give or take 8 feet tall. And then we get this massive description of his armor, a bronze helmet, a breastplate, weighing 5,000 shekels, bronze greaves, a javelin, etc., etc. And what does he do? He stopped and called out to the ranks of Israel. He said to them, "Why should you come out to engage in battle? I am the Philistine, and you are Saul's servants. Choose one of your men and let him come down against me. If he bests me in combat and kills me, we will become your slaves. But if I best him and kill him, you shall be our slaves and serve us." Right? So the idea is, we don't all need to go into battle. Let's have a showdown, right? A single warrior combat. You pick your best man. I'll pick my I'm the best man for the Philistines. Whoever wins takes it all. When Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and terror-stricken. So you get a sense of the, for lack of a better word, impotence of Saul here. He can't do it. He's very, very nervous. There's no way that he can go into battle. The one person who really should be able to go into battle against Goliath is not in the story. And that, of course, is Saul's son, Jonathan, right? Yonatan, who has proven himself to be a warrior in previous stories. He is not in this story. Why? Well, on a literary level, he can't be in the story, because if he was in the story, then David has no chance to step in and become the champion, right? We're going to assume he's busy doing other things somewhere else, but he's not in the story, and Shaul will not take up the challenge. Who comes along? The shepherd boy coming from Beit Lechem. His father sends him with supplies for his older brothers. He's not even in the army. He gets there. He hears of the promise, what the king's going to give to the person who defeats Goliath. And it's just another example of why this is such a great book, right? You have this dialogue of the older brother and the younger brother. Oh, and David says, what's going to happen? And what are you going to get if you win? And his older brother's like, oh, look at you. All you did, you want to just come down here and see the war. And who do you think you are, right? It's such a great smackdown of the older brother of the younger sibling. But David is ready to do it. And he goes to Shaul, he goes to King Saul, and he says, I'm going to go to battle. And Shaul looks at him. He says, who are you, little kid? There's no way you could do this. And here's where we have the important issue of the value of David, right? David says, I am a shepherd, and whenever the lions or the bears come against my sheep, I can best them and I can save my sheep, right? And it sounds like he's talking about how great he is, but it's not. He says, God, who saved me from the lion and the bear, will save me from Goliath, right? This is the major difference between David and Shaul. David has a deep trust and belief that God is always with him, right? David's human relationships are very flawed, but his relationship with God is completely full and natural and perfect, and he believes completely in God. And Shaul doesn't really think this is a great idea, but he sends him out anyway. He wants to put armor on him. David doesn't want it. He can't move. So what does he do? He just goes out with his slingshot, right? And he goes towards the Plishtim. The Philistine was coming closer to David. When the Philistine caught sight of David, he scorned him, for he was but a boy, ruddy and handsome, right? Admoni, right? Maybe red haired, maybe red complexion. The Philistine called out to David, am I a dog that you come against me with sticks? The Philistine cursed David by his God and said to David, come and I will give your flesh to the birds of the sky and the beasts of the field, right? What we would call trash talking today. Who do you think you are? Come here. I'm going to tear you limb from limb. And then we have David's speech. Now, what's important to understand in David's speech is he's not speaking to Goliath. He's not speaking to the Plishtim. He's speaking to all of the Israelites who are standing around and listening, right? Because this is the point of why he's here. He's not here just to defeat the Plishti, but he's here to show that the power of the Plishti, the warrior power, that's not the power that's important, right? Hashem ish milchama, God is the warrior, and you have to trust in God. And that's what he says. David replies to the Philistine, "You come against me with sword and spear and javelin, but I come against you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the ranks of Israel, whom you have defied. This very day the Lord will deliver you into my hands, and all the earth shall know there is a God in Israel. And this whole assembly shall know that the Lord can give victory without sword or spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will deliver you into our hands." Right? It's very much this this plea to the people. You need to understand that the power does not lie in physical power, but it lies in belief in God and belief in how he's going to save us. And when you go today to Tel Azekah, you climb up the hill, you have this amazing view of the valley, and the JNF did this great thing that all the way up, you have these markers with pieces of the story written on them. And at the top, you have this last part of the story, right? David's throwing the slingshot and hitting Goliath in the head and everybody running away, right? So it's a very strong place in which to tell the story. Now, of course, the aftermath of the story is that the Plishtim run away. They regain their power, but at the moment they are routed. David is rewarded. He moves into Shaul's household in Giv'at Shaul, and he marries the king's daughter, and he becomes close with the king's son, except what happens then, right? And he's also brought to play music for Shaul for when the ruach, right, the bad spirits overtake Shaul. But meanwhile, Shaul starts to hear what people are saying about David, right? He kashaul ba'alafav vidavid berivvotav. Saul killed thousands, but David killed tens of thousands. And whatever we want to call it, I'm not going to give a psychological analysis of Shaul. Is he manic depressive? Is he paranoid? This is not for me. I'm not a psychologist. But whatever it is, something takes over him, and he has this terrible, terrible jealousy of David, along with a love for David, by the way. Everybody loves David. There's no one who doesn't love David, right? Everyone falls in love with him and is taken by him. But meanwhile, Shaul also is very jealous of him. And as David realizes the danger to himself, he starts to run away. And this is a great map taken, again, from a Christian Bible site. They have the best stuff. And you can see that here he is. He starts out in Giv'ah, right? Giv'at Shaul, that's where the palace is. And he's, on the one hand, he's an honored member of the king's household. He's a prince. He's best friends with the prince. On the other hand, he has to be on the run. And where does he run to? He starts out very close to home. He goes to Ramah, to Shmuel. He goes to Nov, right? And then he starts to move a little further away. First, he tries to go to the Plishtim and Gat. That's unsuccessful, right? And then he heads out towards the desert, Zif, Carmel, Maon, Ein Gedi, right? We have all of these amazing stories. He sends his parents to Moab, right? He keeps going further and further away in his fear of David, until finally he goes to the one place where he knows Shaul is not going to follow him, because Shaul does follow him to all these other places. And he goes back to Gat, and he goes and he becomes allies with Shaul's most bitter enemy, with Achish. And he pretends that he's working for him, right? Ultimately, he doesn't stay in Gat. He goes under the protection, the auspices of Achish, and he goes down to a place called Siklag, which is still controversial where exactly it is, but somewhere on the edge of the desert. But the fact that he can go to his bitterest enemy and find refuge there, that's very complicated, right? Now, meanwhile, he's managed to gather onto himself all sorts of followers. The Tanakh describes them as Marei Nefesh, right? Kol Ish Mar Nefesh, everybody who's dissatisfied with something. something, everybody who's unhappy about something, and they join him. Now, part of these runnings away, right, and these wanderings is part of David's journey of becoming king. He has to learn how to have followers. He has to learn how to subdue his enemies. He has to learn tolerance and not always acting on his emotions, which very interestingly he learns from Abigail, right, the wife of Nabal in Carmel, who says, no, don't go and kill everybody. That'll be a very bad thing for you, right? He's got to learn all sorts of things on this journey. So part of his running away from Shaul is also part of his becoming ready to be king, right? And it's not a coincidence, it's not an accident that he ends up in the desert, right? On the one hand, the desert is a refuge, but on the other hand, the desert is also a place where you learn to be a leader, right? Think of all the leaders, the prophets, Moshe, Yirmiyahu, Amos, they're all in the desert, right? Because you have to learn how to be a shepherd. You have to be a shepherd of men as well as a shepherd of sheep. You have to learn how to put your trust in God. So all of this running away is also part of David learning how to take the reins of being king. But now we're going to come into our last story, which is a very powerful story. And that's the story, of course, of Shaul's final battle and the end and what happens. So just some locations, right? The Plishtim are coming up, of course, from the coast. They're going via Afek. And they eventually camp in a place called Shunem, which is right south of Gibat HaMoreh, very close to modern day Afula. Okay. King Saul is coming up from the mountains, and he starts out camping in a place called En Yisrael. Okay. There's Tel Yisrael above. There's a spring below En Yisrael. He needs to be by the water. Ultimately, he's going to retreat to the mountain, to the Gilboa. Okay. But he starts out over here. We're going to see the story of his desperation to have some word from God. He actually goes to a Baalat Ov, right, to a soothsayer in order to find out what does God want from him. And where does he go to this Baalat Ov? She's in a place called Ein Dor. Ein Dor is right next to the Plishti camp. Okay, he actually goes over in disguise almost into the Plishti camp because he's so desperate to hear from God or to hear from Shmuel or to hear from someone, right? So that's another location. When he is killed on Har Gilboa, the Plishtim take him, his body and his son's bodies and hang them on the walls of Beit She'an. And ultimately, the people of Yavesh Gilad over here cross over the Jordan to take their bodies down and to bring them back to Yavesh Gilad. Okay, so those are our locations in the story. Meanwhile, what's happening with David, right? While Shaul is going into battle against the Plishtim, hearing about his fate, despite the terrible nature of his fate, going into battle without, you know, hesitating. He knows he's going to die, but he still goes into battle. At the same time, where is David? David is in a very sticky situation. He is with Achish in Gat. The Plishtim are about to leave. They're about to march north. They're going to go to battle against the Israelites. And David, as a loyal servant of Achish, he's going to come along, right? No, he definitely does not want to come along. He doesn't want to fight against his brothers. And he manages somehow to get the other Philistines to doubt him. They're like, oh, this guy, you know, he has killed a lot of Philistines. Maybe we shouldn't take him along with us. And he manages to get out of it. And what does he do? Well, he sounds very depressed. Oh, I can't believe you're not taking me. You don't trust me. But he's secretly very relieved. And he goes back to his camp in this place called Siklag, which may or may not have been discovered recently. It's a place called Chirbit Arai, which is right about here, which some people think is Siklag and some don't. In any case, he gets back there. He has to go on raids. He has to save the women and children who have been captured by the Amalekites, right? And they are down by Nachal Habsor, which is what this is a picture of. What's going on here, right? Why is Tanakh telling us this story and going back and forth, right? Well, we could look at it in a very charitable way. Tanakh is telling us that while the sun of Shaul's kingdom is setting, the sun of David's kingdom is rising, right? We're hearing about him getting ready to take power. You could also look at it very cynically. While Shaul is off fighting for his people, David is off with his band of followers, making sure that he is established and he's sending gifts to all the tribal chiefs of Judah, right? Either way, they are not together. Hey, David is off doing his own thing, and that's why he has to have a messenger come and tell him about the death of King Saul, about the death of Yonatan. Okay, so that's where David is. Now, we have this very strange story, right? Shaul is very nervous. He hasn't heard anything from God. He's about to go into battle. This is one of the things we said before. David is always sure of his support by God. Shaul always needs reassurance. Okay? And he doesn't know where to get that reassurance. Shmuel, the prophet, is dead. He's not getting prophecy from God. He's not getting any dreams. He's not getting anything. What is he going to do? Okay, so here's what we have, chapter 28. Samuel died. All Israel made lament for him. And Saul had forbidden recourse to ghosts and familiar spirits, right? If you remember your Torah, right? Sefer Vayikra, you are not allowed to have a Ba'alat Ov or a Yidoni. This is not what God allows, and King Saul, as a good king, forbids this. And that, of course, is the irony of the story, right? The Philistines mustered and marched to Shunem. Saul gathered all Israel, and when Saul saw the Philistine force, his heart trembled with fear. But the Lord did not answer him by dreams or Urim or prophets. So he says, find me a woman who consults ghosts, a Ba'alat Ov, so I can go to her and inquire through her, right? The ultimate irony. I forbade them, but now I want to go. And his courtiers told him there was a woman in Ein Dor who consulted ghosts. Remember we said Ein Dor, very near the Philistine camp. So he disguises himself. He puts on different clothes. They come to the woman by night. Please divine for me a ghost. Bring me the one I shall name to you, right? And she says, oh, I'm going to get in trouble. He says, no, you're not going to get in trouble. Meanwhile, what does she do? She says, who should I bring up for you? Bring up Samuel for me, Shmuel Hanavi, right? And the woman recognized Samuel and she shrieked loud. And she said, why have you deceived me? You are Saul. And the king said, don't be afraid, right? And the woman said, Saul, I see a divine being coming from the earth. He is an old man. He is wrapped in a robe, right? The Mefarshim say this is the robe that he had that his mother made him when he was little. And Saul knew it was Samuel, and he bowed. Am I still on by you guys? Because I seem to have a power out here. Everything okay? Say yes.
You're good. We see you. Can hear you. Yeah.
Okay.
We can hear you.
Yes. Okay. Good. I don't know why my power has gone out. Okay. And she says, she describes him and then he talks, right? And Shmuel says, why have you disturbed me? And he says, I'm in trouble and God is not answering me. And Shmuel says, look down. Why do you ask me, seeing the Lord has turned away from you and has become your adversary? The Lord has done for himself as he foretold through me. The Lord has torn the kingship out of your hands and has given it to your fellow, to David, because you did not obey the Lord and did not execute his wrath, right? Tomorrow your sons and you will be with me, right? Meaning he will die. This is a terrible, terrible, terrible prophecy. The commentaries disagree, right? Does Shmuel really appear? Does the Ba'alat Hov have powers? Is she a con woman? Is it all in a vision in Shaul's head, right? We have all kinds of different opinions about this. It's a fascinating question. I'll just add what you can see here on the side. One of the early Zionist poets, Shaul Chernyakhovsky, wrote a very famous poem called Ein Dor. I only brought you a little piece of it there, where he very dramatically, describes in the dark of night on the back of a horse, and Dora came King Saul, right? Where does the sorceress live? And this poem, by the way, had a great deal in creating King Saul as a tragic figure, right? He is this ultimate tragic figure, and he never can succeed. Others will very much disagree with this, but it is a fascinating story. I'll just add one last tiny thing. If anybody remembers, the TV show Bewitched from the 70s, what was the name of the mother-in-law? Endora, because there was a Jewish writer and he said, Endora, of course, that's a classic witch, right? That's a great name. So now you know a great little tidbit about 70s TV. Okay, so what happens? Saul goes back. He doesn't shirk his duty. He goes into battle. The Philistines attacked Israel. The men of Israel fled. Many fell on Mount Gilboa. The Philistines pursued Saul and his sons, and they struck down Yonatan, Abinadab, and Malchishua. The battle raged around Saul, and some of the archers hit him, and he was severely wounded by the archers. He's very frightened by the archers. This is very ironic because the Bnei Binyamin, the sons of Benjamin, were known to be masters at archery, right? Something that David's going to say in his kinah, and yet the archers are the ones who managed to strike him down. And then we have this very famous passage, which is very important in a halachic conversation, about suicide, right? Saul said to his arms bearer, draw your sword and run me through so that the uncircumcised may not run me through and make sport of me. But the arms bearer refused, and Saul grasped his sword and fell upon it. And the arms bearer saw that Saul was dead. He too fell on his sword and died with him, right? Can you commit suicide if you're terrified of what's going to happen? We have a different version of the story with the messenger telling David that he actually is the one who kills King Saul. The two don't have to contradict. It could be that Saul tries to kill himself. He's not successful. He's dying. And this guy comes along and finishes him off. The two stories can be reconciled. But they're all lying there on the side of Mount Gilboa. And when the men of Israel on the other side of the valley saw that Saul and his sons were dead, they abandoned the towns and fled, right? There's this terrible defeat. The Philistines came to strip the slain, and they found Saul and his three sons lying on Mount Gilboa. They didn't necessarily know that they had killed the king. But when they come, they discover that. And then we have this terrible disgrace. They cut off his head and stripped him of his armor and sent them throughout the land of the Philistines to spread the news in the temple of their idols and their people. And they placed his armor in the temple of Ashtaroth, and they impaled his body on the wall of Beit Sha'an. So this is the tale of Beit Sha'an. This is a picture from like over 100 years ago where you could see nothing has yet been excavated except on the very top. Was Beit Sha'an a Plishti city? The jury is still out. We know it was a very important Egyptian city, right? We have huge statues, the remains of a palace. The Canaanites were there under Egyptian rule. Later, it becomes an Israelite city. Do the Plishtim actually control it, or are they just using it as a temporary way station? Not so clear. Okay. But meanwhile, this terrible indignity that the bodies are on the wall, right? The people of Yavesh Gilad hear about it, right? Remember Yavesh Gilad? They want to repay Saul for saving them at the very beginning of his kingship. So what do? The inhabitants of Yavesh Gilad, and this we're looking in, this is an amazing view from Beit Sha'an to the mountains of Gilad across the Jordan. All their stalwart men set out and marched all night. They removed the bodies of Saul and his sons from the walls of Beit Sha'an and came to Yavesh and burned them there. And they took the bones and buried them under the tamarisk tree in Yavesh and fasted for 7 days. It takes a very long time for those bones to be brought back to the territory of Binyamin. It only happens towards the end of David's kingship in a very complicated and terrible story where David kills off some of the sons of Shaul's concubine, and then he sees how she protects their bodies, and he sees that he has to do something about the body of Shaul and his sons, and he brings him back. So that's the last part here. Just a minute about Beit Sha'an, right? Beit Sha'an, it starts out just at the top of the tell as this city in the time of the Egyptians, the Canaanites. By Second Temple times, it expands. It becomes a huge, first a Greek, then a Roman and a Byzantine city. If you've never seen the archaeology there, it's an amazing place. It becomes part of a league of 10 cities called the Decapolis. It's the only one on the western side of the Jordan. It gets the name Scythopolis. And today we've unearthed the center, the downtown, with temples, with bathhouses, with hippodromes, with all kinds of things. It's a very, very impressive city. We're not going to talk about the Jewish life there because we are running out of time. But the city thrives and does very well until literally it comes crashing down. The year 749 of the Common Era is a terrible, terrible earthquake in the land of Israel. We have archaeological evidence of it. We have literary evidence of it. You see it very dramatically in Beit Sha'an because all of the pillars fall in the same direction at the same time, right? This terrible earthquake. earthquake. We have a piyut in the Cairo Geniza that talks about it. It's called the Rosh HaShvi'i, the seventh earthquake, because it happens in a year of Shemitah, right? The Shvi'i year, right? B'chafgimel b'shvat, Tzom le'Eretz Yisrael, right? They had a fast day. Tzom ha'Rosh, the fast of the earthquake. Mishum she'Eretz Yisrael rasha, v'naflu mimena harbe arim v'metu tachat ha'charavot chachamim, right? Many cities were destroyed, many people and rabbis were killed. V'yesh lo b'mikraot remez b'zaam titz'ad aretz, right? There's a text that hints to this. Mizman she'charba Yerushalayim ad hazman she Karaharash, Israel, Minyan Bizam, the number of years, if you do the gematria of Bizam from the time of the Korban, yes, I understand that it doesn't work here, but you have to do the, I don't even know exactly. You have to do, some of them are hundreds and not singles. But in any case, they do a cheshbon that from the Korban until the earthquake, this is the number of Za'am. But it's a terrible, terrible event. Okay, our final thing that we're going to do here is to talk about Kinat David. Right? David gets the news about Shaul and Yonatan's death. I don't think it's impossible that he could have conflicting feelings. On the one hand, his nemesis is gone. The way is more or less clear for him to become king. On the other hand, Yonatan was his best friend. Shaul was probably somebody he admired, and he wants to grieve for them. Also, it is politically correct to grieve for them because this is the king, and you want to say things that are going to, the ears of the people are going to be pleased by them. But in any case, whatever the reasoning behind it, he writes an incredibly beautiful poem. We'll just point out a few things about it, right? Lilamed b'nei Yehuda keshet, to teach the sons of Judah keshet, right, archery, because we said the b'nei Binyamin, the people of Binyamin, were master archers. Hatzvi Yisrael al bamotecha chalal ech naflu giborim, that's probably the most famous line here. The glory of Israel lies slain on your heights, how have the mighty fallen? Now, when you say Hatzvi Yisrael, you say the gazelle, the deer. Well, that doesn't make any sense, right? But Tzvi is also another word for beauty and glory, right? Yechezkel says, Eretz Yisrael, Tzvi l'kol ha'aretzot, right? It's the most beautiful of all the lands. So when he says, Hatzvi Yisrael, the beautiful, the glorious of Israel is lying fallen. Al tagidu begat, al tibasru bechutzot Ashkelon. Don't tell this in Gat. Don't tell it in the markets of Ashkelon. When we have excavated in Ashkelon, they've actually found the chutzot Ashkelon. They found the marketplaces of Ashkelon. We know where they were. But here, of course, it's a lament. Don't tell them because they're going to be so happy. And obviously they know, but you know, we don't increase their happiness. We don't want there to be any rain in this terrible place. It should be cursed forever. Of course, it isn't, right? Harei Gilboa are very beautiful. But at the foot of the Gilboa, by the way, is a town called Stei Trumot, right? Named after this. He goes on, Shaul v'Yonatan ne'avim v'ne'imim b'chayim u'bimotam lo nifradu. They were beloved when they were alive, and in their death, they weren't separated, right? And he talks about the Benot Yisrael, the daughters of Israel, how they cry because Shaul protected them and saved them, right? The brotherhood of both Shaul and Yonatan to each other, and Shaul and David. Sarli alecha achi Yonatan, na'amta li ma'od, niflatai avavtcha li me'avat nashim. I grieve for you, my brother Jonathan. You were most dear to me. Your love was wonderful to me more than the love of women. So this is a very powerful kina. It's very poetic. It's very beautiful. And there's no surprise that in modern Israel, where unfortunately we've had many albamotecha chalal, many people who have been killed in battle from the best and the greatest, we use this kina, right? It's used a lot at ceremonies, at army ceremonies, at funerals for soldiers, unfortunately, and it's used in memorials. So here are just a few. This one on the left is literally Hatzvi Yisrael. Here they took the Tzvi as a gazelle. This is in, as a very early memorial. It's in Kiryat Anavim outside Jerusalem. This was a lookout point. There was a battle here. And this was put up in memory of the commander who died in the battle. This one is Yad Lagiborim. I'm from Petach Tikva. If you look carefully, you can see it says Hatzvi Israel Alba Motecha Chalal. This is a memory of four who fell in the 1921 riots in Petach Tikva. And this on the bottom, again, is another, there are so many like this. I just have to pick these, right? I mean, Sharim Kalume Arayot Gaveru from, they were faster than vultures. They were stronger than lions. And this is from the paratroopers memorial outside of Gedera. So it's definitely something that has made its way into modern Israeli military culture, and the poem speaks for itself. Okay, let's see. I think there were many questions. Let's go back and see what they are. Elav Ali makes good wine. Yes. Root is with an E. Gat is a threshing floor, right? The word gat does mean threshing floor. However, it does not seem to, it could be. The truth is, I don't know. I don't know if it's a name that is a Semitic name or it's a Plishti name that means something else. It's a good point. I don't know. The pig diet does tell us something about the origin of the Plishtim, meaning that coming from the Greek islands, pigs are more prevalent there, although there are here as well, but it seems to be something that's coming from outside. The museum, yes, the museum in Ashdod is a great museum, very small, but very nice. Yes. Is it true they found the place in Tel Beit Shemesh that the Ark rested? There is a place not in Tel Beit Shemesh, but near it, where they did find something that they think is a mizbeach, it's an altar, which I'm not sure if that's what you're referring to, but that seems to me the closest to what you're talking about. But other than that, I don't know of anything. Everyone loves David except for his brothers. That's true. Batsheva, yes, Batsheva is a very difficult story, but not what we are talking about right now. But yes, Why is he forgiven for the sin? Because he immediately does tshuva. And the Gemara has many, many issues with this. And this is a complicated story. I'm not going to go into that. Batsheva. Okay. Yes, I'm skipping all the Batshevas. Don't be upset. Somebody thought of Endora before me. Good for you, Tova. Okay. Okay, Batsheva, Shmuel died at 852. Yes, the Gemara just talks about that. Why did he look like an old man? First of all, I hate to tell you, but 52 was an old man, right? In the days before any kind of normal health care, I think 52 was already pretty old. Also, 52 is the Midrash. We don't have any text that says that. It seems he's recognized. And again, is that story, did it really happen, right? Did it happen that way? Did she describe it because she clearly was able to read his mood and understand what was going on? And she was a very good con artist. A lot of good questions. Yes, Shaul would have been a very good subject for a Shakespearean tragedy. Shakespeare used it again. Yeah, I suppose, right? Is Shaul Macbeth? Is Shaul Hamlet? I don't know. Shaul Chernikovsky also wrote Al Harig Yoboa. Yes. David, does he love Michal? Does he love Merav? There's not so much evidence in the text of that. Let's say that way. Okay, Tfilah of Avharachamim. I don't know what the context of that was, right? Shaul could be King Lear. That's thank you. Shakespeare and the Witches of Endor. Yes, well, Shakespeare definitely knew his Bible. Okay, other questions, other comments? No? Okay. Rabbi Kalman had to leave, so I will bid you all farewell and a good Shabbat Shalom, and we will meet Be'ezrat Hashem next week.
Shabbat shalom.
I'm ending the meeting.
Thank you.